and ask you to listen to these two readings and think about them for a moment, and then ask yourself, as you hear them, three questions. I'll repeat the questions afterwards, and then we'll just take a couple of minutes to talk with each other about these three questions. The questions I'm going to ask you to think about: what pictures form in your mind as these two versions are read? Do you feel more comfortable with one version than with the other? Can you personally identify more easily with one version than with the other? And our readings tonight are from this morning's lesson in 1 John.
The second chapter, beginning at the 9th verse. He who says he is in the light and hates his brother is in the darkness still. He who loves his brother abides in the light, and in it there is no cause for stumbling. But he who hates his brother is in the darkness and walks in the darkness and does not know where he is going, because the darkness has blinded his eyes.
1 John chapter 2, beginning with verse 9. She who says she is in the light and hates her sister is in the darkness still. She who loves her sister abides in the light, and in it there is no cause for stumbling. But she who hates her sister is in the darkness and walks in the darkness, and does not know where she is going, because the darkness has blinded her eyes.
A picture is forming in your mind? Do you feel more comfortable with one version than the other? Can you identify more comfortably with one version than the other? Would you take just a moment and maybe groups of about three or four just to talk about those three questions and your reactions to these two verses?
I noticed how much more excluded I felt hearing the he version. After I had heard the she version, I became aware of how much it was he and brother, you know? And I said, oh yeah, I'm not included in that. I'm, you know, the second one's for me, and that's what I do.
Identified more and felt more comfortable with it. Well, obviously then tonight our topic is inclusive language, as defined on the board simply as language that names all who are included. Another way of defining that would be a language that names both sexes when both are meant, and thereby avoids discrimination against one or the other. Inclusive language touches not only that male-female issue, though. It also touches how we address each other in the congregation when we're talking about children and adults. Do we exclude the children or the adults? How about the marrieds and the singles in our congregations? When we talk about family potluck, does it or doesn't it include the singles? When we talk about inclusive language, when we talk in terms of racial mixtures in our congregations or in our communities. So primarily we tend to focus on the male-female issue of inclusive language. It is much broader, and I think that would be an important point to keep in mind this evening. The panel, as we were talking, agreed that the language does two things. It reveals what we're thinking about. It reveals images that we have, pictures that we have. The second thing it does is that it focuses or shapes how we perceive each other. Other ways of describing these two functions are descriptive language and prescriptive language. Descriptive being that which describes how things are. It's primarily a past emphasis or a present emphasis. It would be, since in our own congregations the clergy have primarily been male, we would say the pastor he. The other side of language, though, and the other power of language, is to be prescriptive. That which sets out rules or defines authority for us. It's more future-oriented. And in this sense, when we talk about the church as it's progressing and growing, where the clergy includes male and female, prescriptive language would say the pastor, he or she. We feel that language is a powerful tool. It can either reinforce the stereotypes that we have, or it can change our perceptions and help us to develop new ones. I didn't introduce myself. I'm Issa Spoonheim. I'm from Chico, California, and I'm serving on this panel probably because, as we were talking, I discovered that my sense of the descriptive nature of language has been very comfortable, but it's only been in recent two or three years that I have come to understand the importance and the power of the prescriptive quality of language that will help me change perceptions that I have and grow.
I'm Evelyn Strang from Texas Lutheran College, and I guess I grew up hearing the passages such as the one we read from 1 John, and thinking I was included when it said he and brother, because I had that comforting feeling. I knew they were also talking to me, but it bothered me a little bit. But also it's been in, I guess, the last 10 years that my consciousness has been raised to recognize that there are many, many women who I know who have felt left out. And the more I've read and the more experiences I've had, I've recognized that language is very important, even though not all of my friends will agree with me. Some of my best friends will say language makes no difference. You can say he and it means everyone. I now feel differently, and it's a matter, I guess, of consciousness raising wherever I am. In the church, I've seen exciting things happen. I know that this has happened in the LTA. It happened in the American Lutheran Church, of which I've been a part of the Task Force for Women, where we made these recommendations to the church that in our language, in any official language and so on, that we should be very careful to use inclusive language. You see this reflected in the New Lutheran Book of Worship. If you know a lot of hymns by memory, you may notice there are a few words that trip you up. At Christmas we sang Good Christian Men. Oops, no, it's Good Christian Friends Rejoice, or Good Christian Folk, or something like that. Well, you know, some people say that's nitpicking. You know, what difference does it make? I mean, that's the way the hymn was written, and so on and so forth. But I guess being sensitive to the importance of all people, whoever they are, feeling that the language includes them, has brought about this kind of change in the church. Some of the ones were pretty obvious, some of the needs for change. I recall an installation service in my home congregation where two of my friends who happened to be women were installed on the church council, and the pastor was using the old format, the rubrics for the installation of church council. He was reading, Dear Brothers, and here was Brother Dorothy, you know. And of course I get it, my friend the pastor, Brother Dorothy, and about Brother Dorothy, he didn't do it again. But I think there have been many things like this. We've listened to, you know, benedictions and whatnot, and sons of God, and so on and so forth. We've listened to that, and we've never recognized that, hey, you know, there are some people who don't feel they're sons of God because they're daughters of God or something. And so I think the changes in the church have been important. Also, not only in the church, but in the educational circles, some of them are important just from a legal standpoint. For example, if you write a job description, let's say on a college campus or something like that, and you're looking for a person to fill a particular position, if you have fair employment practices and everything and non-discriminatory policies, you must be very careful to word your job description in language that leaves it open to anyone. And I think congregations need to be aware of this. If they're doing any advertising for specific persons who might be church school teachers or choir directors or something like that, they must be very careful in their language. Now, the guidelines to use language that is inclusive have been adopted by the American Lutheran Church and by the Lutheran Church in America. I do not know about other practices beyond that, but I mean, there have been guidelines given to all boards and divisions and so on and so forth. So this is an exciting thing, I think, that has happened in the last year, that we have been conscious that language may make a difference and does make a difference.
My name is Susie Kittner. I'm in seminary. I've completed 1 year of hospital chaplaincy and 3 years of classroom instruction, and have only my internship to serve, which will be in Michigan this year. Language, or inclusive language for me, is mainly something that I've kind of become aware of lately. There's a lot of changes going on. A new worship book, women in seminary, the classes taught in seminary, and among all of those changes, language is certainly one of them. People are naturally are curious about what it's like to be a woman in seminary now, and I enjoy talking about that. having to answer hard questions has helped me to nail down why am I there and what does it mean and what do I do if. The one question that bothers me the most, I can handle most of the questions. You know, I love the chance to write my own ticket, and that's what I think I get to do most of the time. But the one question that jars me the most is when someone says, well, then we'll call you a pastorette, won't we? Well, anyone who studies language knows that the ETT ending is a diminutive. Well, I'm not half a pastor or a third of a pastor or two-thirds a pastor. I'm a pastor that happens to be a woman. And I smile and I say, well, a doctor that happens to be a woman is a woman doctor, is a doctor. A pastor that happens to be a woman is a pastor. I think, though, that little exchange, I get that about once a month, and it feels good to be able to say it out loud to a whole group so we can laugh about it now, is that, first of all, language is descriptive and prescriptive. It also says what we're thinking in a very loud way. People who say that language has no meaning or that we don't, or no power, or that we don't have to be careful would be very offended if I used a rather Anglo-Saxon exclamatory phrase right now. I think that is one of the most powerful ways that we can say language has power and meaning. The other point I want to make is the one about the word man. I am confused with the word man, or I was confused, whether it is one or whether it is all. And I have decided that for me, man or men means only the individual Homo sapien male. Therefore, it is mail carrier, firefighter, flight attendant, etc., etc., etc. And I feel very strongly that the prescriptive nature of language, the pastor he or she, is a constant reminder to all of us that there are women in seminary who take their faith very seriously and wish to serve. So that is one of the things that's most important to me.
My name is Bruce Benson. I'm a parish pastor from Billings, Montana. And my primary concern with inclusive language is a pastoral concern, though the major reason I'm on the panel and the major reason I'm concerned is probably because I happen to like women. And if you like women, it doesn't take too long before you notice many ways in which they are left out by the way we use our language. I have to regularly stand in front of a congregation of Christian people, and on a normal Sunday, most of the people at whom I'm looking are females, not males. And I suspect that that is true in most Lutheran congregations in this country. When I use the language of particularly our old hymnal, when I use the language of scripture, I have become increasingly aware of how more than half of the people who are listening to what I have to say are listening to male-oriented language and not language that tends to include them. I don't know for sure why I've become conscious of that, except, like I said, because I happen to like women. My other pastoral concern, then, is in addition to my concern that the women of the congregations I serve are included in what I say, my other pastoral concern is that the issue of language not be turned into weaponry that we use against each other. Normally, what happens when we discuss an issue like inclusive language is that men and women, or males and females, line up on opposite sides of the issue, or women libbers and anti-women libbers line up on opposite sides of the issue, and we tend to use language as weapons instead of ways to communicate with each other, ways to speak to and to hear each other. And it is my concern that in our use of language tonight, we also exercise some pastoring for each other and try to listen to the issue, try to listen to the concerns of inclusive language with an eye to caring for the people who may feel left out by the way we speak. In order that the discussion can center around the issue of how we talk about each other, we on the panel tonight would like to make a no-no out of one subject, and that subject is the language that we use to talk about God. We will not discuss whether it is appropriate or inappropriate to call God Mother instead of Father, or whether God can be referred to with she instead of he. If we would like to discuss that some other night, we'd be more than happy to do that.
but for the sake of limiting discussion to how we talk about each other, let's please make that a no-no for tonight. The discussion is open to you.
Perhaps we need some new pronouns. Pronouns to take the place of he and of she to mean both. You might have D or you might have Lee. But just put an idea. Because you need a pronoun. And he doesn't work and she doesn't work in some instances. You need a different one.
Because he, she is clumsy.
Well, you need something for clumsy. In the same way, in man, mankind is sort of awkward. We have a good parallel with the German word mensch.
People, yeah. Humans.
Apparently in the language, the word man in its earlier days, about 1,000 years ago, was inclusive. I mean, like the German word mensch was inclusive of all people, but what has happened to the language is the language changes, and that it really got to be a limiting thing. So some of the words that were good to begin with and were inclusive have changed their meaning.
I wonder if that happened to the language or whether that happened to us. I think, you know, I sort of feel like the language kept on, but it's sort of, well, maybe like an allergy or something. Once you sensitize to something, then it only takes just one little grain of pollen, and immediately, you know, everything clogs up. And it's like, I think that's happened. It's, you know, it's in itself just one little thing, but it when we're sensitized, it becomes big. I go along, and it's easy for me to hear the brother-sister thing, you know, doing this rubric for women and calling them brother. But Isa, you mentioned that language was a tool, and I think I take exception to that. I don't know if my language is a tool, where I will stand while I use the tool or while I operate on the tool. I in a sense, I am my language, as some of the rest of you are saying, too. And I'm not sure how language can be a tool. Would you address that?
I think that it's a method or a means we use to communicate. I think we've all been in situations where we have communicated without using language. A hug, I think Hans's devotion this evening talked about lots of kinds of communication going on at the farewell. Our language is one other method that we use to reach out to other people, to make connections with other people.
Oh.
I think it's two-edged is part of the problem. I think that gets back to that descriptive, prescriptive distinction that both Susie and I were trying to make. That it both is what grows out of us and our experience, but it also is how we shape and have some control over how we reach out to other people.
You know, if I get into the habit of using a certain speech pattern like you know, or perhaps there are others that are coming into vogue now, and if I try, first of all, I find it almost impossible to hear myself doing it. If someone says to me, you say that all the time, I say, no, I don't. I never say that. But then maybe I get past that to the point where I perhaps realize I'm doing it and find that I cannot talk at all. Because that phrase will come out of my mouth. It will. Now, the only thing that pulls me out of that, I think, is when something else comes to take its place. When what is happening with me overcomes that kind of falling back on myself, I don't know quite what the mechanism is, but if someone, I think you'll hear someone speaking and using that phrase, you know, or something, and then they get really fired up about something and it disappears. There's no time to throw in junk because something else is, you know, more important. I did, yes. You see how difficult it is when I try to make language a tool and operate on it. I can't do it. I've got no, there's no room between me and my language. I cannot be in between those two things.
That's where I would disagree with you. I'd say that's where our own work has to come in. That I can consciously work at changing my language pattern. I can consciously, if I'm in trying to be in dialogue with you on a political issue, I can consciously choose not to use certain words that I know are going to send up red flags. You know, if I really want to communicate, I'm going to make a real effort to do that which is going to let the communication flow. That's going to mean I'm going to step on my tongue sometimes. Not say that which is emotionally
okay,
feeding
right.
me.
Now, you don't have to say everything that comes to your mind,
exactly.
Like Jack said to us this morning. That, you know, that's fine. I go with that. I don't take that to be using language as a tool, though. I take that to be an action of the spirit. It's an expression of the person, but it's not operating on language. It doesn't change language. It's a function of the spirit.
It changes how we use it, though.
Well, I change how I use it. I choose how
exactly.
I use it.
I think that's the point you were trying to make.
Well, that doesn't make language a tool, I think. It's merely an expression of who I am. It's an expression of my spirit. And if my spirit chooses not to, if my spirit chooses to take a particular route, my language will be that. An expression of my spirit.
We wouldn't want to do anything to prevent you from being a free spirit.
Yeah, but I think what you're saying is that there will be times when you will consciously choose to use different language because you have been sensitized to that this language is offensive to someone. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
For example, in another context, I've heard it this week in some discussion, someone was talking about the issue. I mean, there's really a black and white on that issue. Well, that's a very dangerous phrase to use in some contexts, because black is there meant to be the bad and white is meant to be good. If you've worked in a black community for some time, you don't drop phrases like that. You see, your consciousness has been raised that black is beautiful, and when you use black as the bad and white as the good, I mean, that is just a no-no. So it's a case of consciousness, of sensitivity to what may offend people and what may really, irritate them.
One thing that I found that irritates some people is when I'm so conscious of them that nobody meets them at all. There was a fellow here one winter that I couldn't talk to because every time I opened my mouth, I heard things coming out of it that I was afraid would offend him. And I couldn't be around him at all. I didn't dare. I could not go and speak with him because I experienced him as a pincushion. He was just prickly, just that. And I couldn't get next to him at all. That's my fear when I try to clean up my language. I've got a real problem with that.
You're expressing one common feeling, I think, that we all have, Keith, and that is that it is hard, hard work to change your language. It is not natural. It takes a great deal of effort. And I suppose the question is whether in any situation, whether the cause is worth the effort.
One word that really upsets me is teenager. The teen program of Holden. Doesn't that upset you?
You mean the teen program or the
the use of language. That kind of language.
Yes, but I don't have another word.
You can say something about maybe it fits under the prescriptive part of languages, how it can also be used to, especially relating to the male-female thing, where people can really exert power by the way they use language. And we have a couple of doctors where I work at the hospital, and there's one that's just notorious. I mean, nobody likes him, but he'll come in, well, hello, young ladies, and he uses a lot of really condescending terms, and that just puts a whole barrier between he and and the staff, and that kind of thing. He's often throwing out, and he's the same doctor that says you have to call every patient by their last name, Mr. or Mrs. so-and-so. And, you know, one of our nurses finally said, well, then you can call me Mrs. Fridlington. You know, and but that's a real situation where, you know, he uses that language as a real power kind of thing. And he uses other kinds of things for power also. But, you know, there's a lot of those kinds of things. And I'm sure that happens in business and management occasionally where, you know, women are kind of put in their place by, well, hello, young lady, or...
Or how are you girls this morning?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or I think what you also mentioned, the use of first names versus mm-hmm. titles.
Mm-hmm.
We frequently do that with children, but also many times doctor-patient relationships. How many of you would think to call your doctor by his first name? And yet how many times does he call you by your first name? And we feel comfortable with that usually when there's a hierarchy that we sense.
If it makes you feel any better, nobody said that all doctors are masculine, but Issa just said, when you talk to your doctor, what does he?
More questions?
You see these as points in congregation, I mean, if questions, in congregations, for example, do you get into discussions? Like if you're having a session for calling a pastor or something like this, where you find all the language is male language. I mean, this happened in my congregation recently, and here was a call committee, and here was talk about this. And someone has to get up and say, hey, you know, let's listen to ourselves. I mean, do you do that? I mean, or do you just let it go on, that they're only saying, now the pastor we want... Now we want him to do this, or we think he should do this. I mean, if this goes on in a congregation, does one just let it ride, or are there some responsibilities? That's one thing.
I think that in the last night I was reading an article in the library that said in the American Lutheran Church, some 6,600 members of the clergy roster, only 18 are women, and it might be that that applies in 6,580 situations, which I suppose poses a more serious problem than just language. I knew that there were a lot of women in seminary. I had no idea there were only 18 on our clergy roster.
The statistics right now are that roughly 30% of the seminary population are women, and it from the time I entered in seminary, it was say 8%, and then it jumped to 12%, and then it jumped to 20%, then it jumped to 30%. The first time that the rest of the church will be called to deal with that beyond the seminary level is next year. When you open up the Lutheran Standard, you know, one-third of the pictures are going to be of women. And I, yes, it's only 18 now. But the church made a commitment, and the church means us. I'll carry the banner as long as I have to, and I'm not going to apologize for it.
I wanted to point up another point just about the state of the church on that matter.
And the reason that I think what she's saying is so important is that we've got to lay some groundwork. We don't change language overnight, and we don't change some clergy rosters overnight.
We've been, just as a footnote to your comment, we have been working for the last 4 or 5 months on revising our constitution. And one of the reasons why we wanted to do it was because our constitution was written in such a way that it would be possible if someone wanted to make a point of it that we could only call a man. And so we have been working through that, and we have a cross-section of membership working on it. And I've been pleasantly surprised at how easy it is to rewrite the constitution without making it sound awkward or trendy or
yeah.
anything like that.
Yeah.
Just. You know, it's possible to rewrite that document in a sensible manner.
May we say also that helps men? Because, for example, I've been involved in revising school board policies and things like that, or you could have it in relation to your Sunday church school. If you limit the language describing elementary teachers or church school teachers to she, I think that's very unfortunate. That sometimes happens. And we certainly need men working with young children. Well, our language may almost make men feel uncomfortable doing that. So it works both ways.
The other way it's beneficial to men is that it's not only the language of God's grace in Scripture that seems addressed to males, it's also the language of His judgment, and we'd be just as happy to share that as not.
Yeah.
basically I'm in agreement with you that we do live in symbolic realities, and these symbolic realities determine how we think, how we evaluate people. But I like to play the devil's advocate, if I may. Where do you intend to stop this? That is to say, how far do you want to go? In the immortal words of Ted Baxter, if God had intended men and women to be created equal, then we'd all be flat all over. If God had intended men and women to be created equal, then we'd all be flat all over. Where do you want us to be in terms of men and women? Are there going to be no differences? Are there going to be some differences? Is it going to be strictly regarding to physiological sex and equal and everything else, or where? As I said, it's kind of a dumb, bottomless question, but I'd like to get your response.
Well, which question of those 25 do you want to have?
Okay, how far do you want to go with it?
You mean as far as language or as roles of men and women relating?
Well, you can't separate the two. They both go together.
Okay. Personally, I want the room to creatively change roles. That means that the man I marry, I hope, can be as creative as I can, as I am, in the things I'll have to learn. Not just one job. That I'll have the room and the place to have a home and family and a job. Now, that is not an easy task, no, because the vision of success that we have in the world today, that's slowly changing, does not allow for home and family. Now, if I could have a wife, I'm sure I'd do great. I want it to go to the point that I am free to do what I want, no holds barred. Now it's to the point that when I walk into a church as a supply minister, people aren't quite sure how to say hello. They've never seen one before. Fine. I've done that before. I've been the new one around. I know how to work with that. I want it to be to the point that it's not that way anymore. I want us to be able to grow and be free and be unburdened. You know, sometimes I get so conscious I feel a little neurotic. You know, this is the next thing to be conscious about. I want it to be a growing and a freeing thing to see men and women, women and men, in roles of authority, in roles of decision making, and in supportive roles. I want there to be a pretty free exchange on that level. And that means things are going to have to change. And that also means that it's not going to be easy. You were talking how clumsy it is to say he or she. Well, I've been saying it for 4 years now, and it comes pretty cold, pretty quickly. I agree. You know, when we change things, it's bumpy for a while. But I want to take it as far as I can.
I think the language issue, from what people were saying, becomes very simple then to me, as simple as that few word definition on the board. It is simply that if you want to include the women and the men, you say that. If you want a layman's retreat, you say a layman's retreat. If you want a retreat for the laity of the congregation, you say for the laity of the congregation. You choose your language to say precisely what you want to say. So that we're not confusing, we're not saying, does that include me? Or doesn't it? We just get rid of the ambiguity. Why do we need ambiguity in our language?
How are we going to avoid it?
By working at precision.
I really think it's an impossible task. I wish you luck, but I think it's an impossible task.
I'm not saying we're ever going to accomplish it, but I think we need to make the effort if we really want to talk with each other and not just alienate.
Is the word husband a value-free word, for example? I mean, is the word husband an acceptable word for the male member of a marriage relationship? Or does it imply husbanding and thus ruling or controlling?
Me,
where does it end?
To me, husband does not have implications of ruling or controlling.
Well, but wait,
husband and wife talk about a relationship.
in a somewhat different relationship than man-woman, brother-sister, is defining a relationship, but I don't automatically read into that any ruling or ruled implication.
The key point is that if you were to do language study, that particular word, what you find in the background, is, you know, would be comparable to a person who husbands the land or his flock with some kind of sense of ownership or at least superiority to that which he's husbanding. You know, and so if you're going to take a look at that word, is that really what you want to imply about the relationship your mate has to you?
Maybe it'll be spouse M and spouse F, you know. But perhaps even male and female are not acceptable. You see what I'm saying? It's a question of spirit. And it's got to be spirit. If we try to clean up ourselves with our language, I firmly believe we are going to crash.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean when you say spirit. No, I think the point here is that the devil's advocate question you raised is right in line with this. I think what you're saying is that how far are you going to carry the language game? And I think the husband question is an illustration of that. You can really carry that language game so far that it is myth-making. That's right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that would agree with that. Aren't you saying the same thing as this man?
Well, I think it does tie together, yes.
Yeah. And now, then, how far do you take it will depend on to what extent the language is really an irritant to persons. And that may depend on the situation. You don't force the issue. Maybe you do move by the spirit in love. But to push the language, you know, to its extreme, I mean, it can be ridiculous. It can be mystical. But if it is offensive to people with whom you deal, then in the spirit, you seek to deal with them in love, and maybe you try to watch your language.
I like your answer. In the sense that you were talking about the growth and the development that stereotypes don't allow. However, that it does make it very difficult because it's so much easier to use stereotypes. You know, we think of stereotypes all the time, like you come zooming up the door, you push it. 99 times out of 100, it'll be open, you fly through, but that one time, you know, you have your face or your nose squished against there. Mm-hmm. Well, the stereotype is public doors are open. So they tend to work most of the time, but when they tend to, I think, depress growth and development of people, then they ought to change. So I like the answer.
I think it's important that children have a chance to learn to use inclusive language. Does anybody on the panel know how serious school textbook companies are taking the language and picture symbolism in the textbook?
Maybe you should share that.
Well, we were looking at a study earlier. This book is in the bookstore, by the way. It's called Words and Women. It's by Casey Miller and Kate Swift. I think it's an excellent, very concise study of how language affects us. You raised an issue of in other studies that they do mention about how language affects children and textbooks. I can think of just some brief examples until very recently in all the elementary school textbooks. Mother was easy to define. She always wore an apron. I don't know how many of you wear aprons all the time, but even in the fairy tales, Mama Bear wore an apron. Some real little definitions in things like this. One study that we were looking at, and I don't know if it relates directly to this, but it was a study done in 1972 at Drake University. Two sociologists decided to test the hypothesis that man, M-A-N, quote, is generally understood to embrace woman, inclusive. In other words, 300 college students were asked to select from magazines and newspapers a variety of pictures that would appropriately illustrate the different chapters of the sociology textbook being prepared for publication. Half the students were assigned chapter headings like social man, industrial man, and political man. The other half were given different but corresponding headings like society, industrial life, and political behavior. Analysis of the pictures selected revealed that in the minds of students of both sexes, use of the word man evoked to a statistically significant degree images of males only. filtering out recognition of women's participation in these major areas of life, whereas the corresponding headings without man evoke images of both males and females. When they go on to describe the studies more, but some of the real interesting things, besides the fact that those that listed man were heavily male, they were heavily middle class, white male oriented. So it was not only sexist, but it was racist. It was an economic stratification. It was really exclusive in lots of ways. Some of the hopeful signs, such as in the areas on urban life versus urban man, when it talked about urban life and left out the man language, were there signs of hope like people playing in parks. Much stronger incidence of minorities showing up, men and women, all races, all ages, showing up when the term man was left out of the chapter heading. They say at some point statistical difference was as high as 30% to 40%. Now, on the university level, we think of most of our college students as fairly conscious of language. At least they're in a position where they're forced to use language daily. This has got to be coming up from elementary school. And I think most of our textbooks have reflected that until the last 2 years, and there have been some real changes. I was pleased to see in some of the first and second grade textbooks my children were using minorities, poncho, black children, brown children, white children, mixed together. The girls not always in the house helping mommy, but the girls outside playing ball with the boys. The boys helping with the house. The variety of things, getting away from that role-exclusive behavior that Susie was talking about. So change is happening. Moment.
As we grow up and we learn to use language as we're children, we go through a very concrete stage. You know, chair, book, table, fireplace, microphone, chimney. And that's where that word, that confusion for man comes in. You know, man or man. And I, boy, I talk about hope. You know, I've seen a lot of things slowly moving to address the situation, and that's exciting. Sometimes, I used to get very upset about it and say, well, why isn't it happening now? But I can see that it's a much larger change than I ever realized.
No, it's been very dramatic. One of the things I do deal with is children's science textbooks. And I can look at books that are 10, 15 years old, and all the language is about the scientist does this, he may work in the laboratory, he may do this, and the illustrations have been almost exclusively masculine. There's been a dramatic change. The publishers are conscious, believe me. They are really conscious, and they're coming through in most instances.
Eric Fromm, one of the most classic statements discussing his, I don't know where, was man being a mammal breastfeeds with milk. Man being a mammal breastfeeds his young. So difficult. Well, education is changing. One place that we are being slow, I have to say, is in the church. At least as of last fall, when I happened to see a fifth grade AL, the Good News curriculum, was called Men of Faith, and it was only men.
I'm sure there are some here that have hurt me the other day when I expressed about 2 Sundays ago we had a new minister in the pulpit, during the service he would say, man has striven for good, for right, man has striven for this, and so on, and it was continuously man, 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 and all of a sudden in the sermon it said, we're talking about this beautiful, beautiful cross with precious jewelry in it that was in this church, and the woman coveted this cross. Mm-hmm. She wanted the cross, and it ended up she made a fake cross that looked just like it and took the real one, you know. And so here was all these men doing the right thing, and here's a woman that coveted, you know. And I'm not a feminist. In fact, some of the things that are being discussed, I really haven't had the conscious race in yet, I guess. And I'm still old-fashioned. I still maybe want a dominating male. So sometimes I think we push our ideas onto somebody else, you know, that they're not ready for. But anyway, so I did go up to the minister afterwards, and I mentioned to him that I enjoyed his sermon, which I did very much, but I said there were 2 points I wanted to bring out. And so I did bring out the 2 points about the man, and yet it was only the woman that coveted the beautiful cross. And he thanked me, and we had quite a discussion about it, and he said that he deals mainly with men, but he did thank me, and he said he would watch it, you know, from then on. So I think to bring it out in the open many times does help.
Yes. Yeah, it's not only the male-female issue that comes in, but just inclusiveness of all different kinds of things, you know, lifestyle kinds of things that can often be excluded in terms, you know, everything referring to family as opposed to single, and same kinds of things with children's material. You know, if they don't refer to single-parent families, which are definitely a reality, you know, for good or bad, you know, those are things that if a kid sees something, always mother and father, you know, what that impact might be for that child is, you know, my odds because I don't have another parent. So there's lots of various besides the male female thing that we often exclude people, you know, people with certain kinds of disabilities or, you know, different lifestyles. And, you know, it's more than just the male female.
Mm-hmm. I happen to be one of the male elementary school teachers. It doesn't upset me at all when I'm often referred to as she, or anyone knows who I am. That's okay, you know. But I think if you're comfortable with who you are, it really doesn't make that much difference. As far as the single parent family in the Houghton Mifflin series, it was just put out, Windows on Our World, a series on social studies. The nuclear family is now described as one parent and one child. And those books were published 2 years ago. So there are.
It also goes, family does not have to have children. Mm-hmm. That I see a lot too. It's always mom, dad, son, daughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't want to make the church sound like it's all behind, because several years ago at Oxford Vacation Bible School series on family, they were very careful to define family as being any one of a number of combinations, from no children to many children to single parents to adoptive situations. So it's not that they're totally in the dark ages or unaware of the exclusivity of some of our language.
But I think that the difficult part comes, again, with something you said this morning, Jack, and that is to know something means we have to act on it. I would bet that most everyone in this room has heard part of this conversation before. I mean, there seems to be kind of a quietness and kind of a, yeah, sure, feeling that I sense. And I think that the next step is the one where you kind of have to take a deep breath, you know, and say sentences that sound funny for a while, if we choose to do that.
Well, I think what is great is that Jean's saying that she has not been particularly concerned about this issue, yet here was a specific illustration where she could, in kindness and concern for the pastor, I mean, to do that kind of thing, talk to him freely. Now, that's beautiful. I mean, there comes a certain point you may go along, and then all of a sudden it hits you. And you may talk to a pastor, a friend, or someone who is using language in a way that really bothers you and that you know more than other people, and you tell them about it because you care about them.
Sometimes, even if it doesn't bother me, but if I know that it's turning some other people off, particularly in worship,
mm-hmm.
if we know our language is shutting off some people because they get blocked on words like mankind or other words used in that sentence, out of concern that their worship is false, we should try to perfect our use of language and in that sense. Even though it may not bother me, I may be very comfortable with those terms. But language is not the form of tissue. It's worship, or it's communication, or it's trying to relate to one another as brothers and sisters. And we've got to do whatever is necessary, I think, to allow that to happen. And if language is a red flag, then we work to change that. If the way I dress is a red flag, well, sometimes maybe it means that I don't go in wearing something that I know is going to alienate people. I don't know. These are things that we all have to wrestle with, I think. But the issue is, how do we communicate?
I don't really know how far I want this language change to go. I definitely feel that in a lot of cases that things do have to change. But just thinking in general, I think that the degree to which the language changes will depend upon how much of a thorn in the side of everyone advocates of language change are. And the only thing I can compare it to, it's a much smaller thing than changing the whole gender issue, but the word Negro has practically been wiped out of the language in a very short time, just because of the vehemence with which blacks word against terms like that. But I was also thinking of the term Afro-American, which was another term introduced by blacks. This was a favorable term to them, and that term pretty much sputtered out, except for organizations and things like that, because it wasn't an easy word to use. It wasn't a practical word. So I think another thing, besides being a thorn in the side of people who of offenders, is the types of changes made, whether they're practical and workable or whether they're uncomfortable or not. I don't think an uncomfortable word is ever going to work.
In liturgy, it's interesting that some of the uses of man or men were superfluous, like in the Nicene Creed, who for us, men. All you had to do was to drop the word men. It served no purpose, which the new creed does. And those the thing, again, referring back to the constitutional thing, and also in LBW, to see how easy it is to make those changes in such a way that they're not awkward. And the creeds and a lot of the things that are standard forms now in the LBW that will be that way for at least 15 or 20 years. sound very normal. They don't sound out of it.
I think that we shouldn't be so concerned with how far do we have to take this, because that's not really the problem. I think the point is half of our Christian body, or a portion of half of the Christian body, is having a problem feeling included. And I think that the process of change is exactly that, is a process. And we have a problem with attitude when we say, well, Jesus is so expansive, let's just not even begin, you know. It's just silly, let's just head out and see what happens. I've met some women at the University of Minnesota who have become so sensitized to their exclusion from our religion that they've turned to witchcraft. Now, whether that's right or wrong, and that's not the issue tonight, but I think that that's an illustration of the fact that we have a problem here, and that we as a body should do something and not just say, well, how far should, you know, we don't know how far to go, so, you know, let's just kind of hang back. And we just have to take a first step.